This week, the Pope will be in Barcelona to officially bless the completed final tower of La Sagrada Familia, the monumental Catholic basilica, more than 144 years in the making. The blessing will coincide with the centenary of its architect, Antoni Gaudí's death. Today, against the odds, the exterior of his extraordinary temple is finally complete. New Zealand-born architect Mark Burry AO spent nearly 40 years working on Gaudí's masterpiece, recruited in Barcelona as a wide-eyed 22-year-old student in 1979. These days, Mark is adjunct professor at Swinburne University of Technology's School of Design and Architecture and a senior faculty member at the Institute for Advanced Architecture of Catalonia. And he joins me from Adelaide. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Tracy.
I'm really interested to know how you wound up working on Gaudi's masterpiece back in 1979.
I was a student in England, and we were counselled not to take any interest in Gaudi because he was too weird. And being from this part of the world, that was a green light to go and find out more. And I just ended up, I got a scholarship to do a small thesis and interviewed the two 90-year-old architects who were in charge of taking the project forward. And that led to an invitation to join the team.
Incredible. So this is back in the 1970s and into the 80s. You say there wasn't a lot of interest in Gaudi in the architectural establishment at the time. In fact, they were trying to turn people off a focus on him. Why was that?
Well, I was being educated at the end of the modern movement. And if you think most of our cities and think Gaudí, you'll see there's a huge difference between them. So we were being promoted towards the rectilinear and the vertical, not the curvy and sculptural of Gaudí. And my sensibilities lay more with Gaudí than with the modern movement.
And also, it was just a few years after the Franco dictatorship, wasn't it? And that part of the country had become something of a pariah.
Yeah, you'll see that when you look for books on Spanish art and architecture, any time after the 1940 through to the 70s is very little. It was sort of like a non-new topic of interest. I didn't have any of that particular baggage, combination of youth and from where I hailed. And so just went for it.
Yeah, and you went there with an open mind, obviously, but how did you converse with people? How was your Spanish or Catalan?
The context is that the building was, from my point of view, abandoned. That's what we'd been taught. And when I arrived there, I found that, in fact, it was very much alive and that they'd duplicated the original transept that Gaudí, then the nativity facade, then sort of built a version of it as the passion facade on the other side. But the team was only two 90-year-old architects who had known Gaudí when they were young architects themselves, and four technicians. And I arrived at exactly the time that they were thinking about the main body of the church, the nave. So in terms of communication, I had no Catalan or Spanish and they had no English. So it was my schoolboy French and they were a bit more au fait. And I just asked a couple of questions that sort of got their interest, and that's what led to the opportunity of going to work there.
Do you think it was your open-mindedness that made them engage with you in such a way to include you and make you such a part of the process?
The initial invitation, the opportunity to interview them was their open-mindedness. I think they were surprised to have a young Cambridge graduate sort of asking tricky questions. But the questions I asked were, I really was interested in knowing where was the authority to continue such an extraordinary building with the master dead for over 50 years at that point? And even if they felt they knew what he wanted, how did they communicate to the people actually building it what their task was? And that turned out to be exactly the questions that they were embracing themselves. So I don't know how we managed to get that across in my schoolboy French, but it obviously worked.
And how slow was progress at the time?
Well, I'm not allowed to say this, but genuinely, the two directors, they felt the building would be finished in 10 years.
Okay.
And I regard my unbridled optimism, which has carried me forth hence from there, from meeting these two characters. No, it was very, very slow. I mean, criminally slow.
And they must have been characters to still be so committed to it into their 90s. But let's talk about Gaudí, the man. Who was he and how did he first get the job on this temple?
He's an enigma. He was trained in Barcelona, but he came from a village, from a family. His father was a kettle maker, a sort of artisan in the south of part of Catalonia. So he was an impoverished student, and it's always a strange, unanswered question. How did someone so young get the carriage of such an important project? But the point is, at the time that he was invited to become the executive architect, it was a project that had already commenced under another architect who resigned after a year, and it was effectively the size of a parish church. So what they thought they were commissioning was a young, impoverished, recently graduated architect to simply undertake the design that had been made by a very well-known architect who had resigned from the project after a year.
So La Sagrada Familia basically translates to the Holy Family. Who was it being built for? What was the purpose of the building?
So the full name is the Expiatory Temple or Church of the Holy Family. Expiatory implies atonement for sins through expiation. So from the get-go, it was a crowdsourced building, a funded building, by a foundation that had been established in the name of Joseph, father of Jesus. And they were worried about the social changes of Barcelona in the mid-1800s. Due to rapid industrialization and the loss of family values. That's all very familiar.
The same things just go round and round, don't they?
They do, it's sad, yeah. And so they were called the devotees of St. Joseph, and they bought a site and sought funding to build a church in honor of the patriarch, which is Joseph. So that was the foundation of it.
And he turned this more modest project into his grand vision, didn't he? Were there protests at the time? Were there supporters of his that protected him? I mean, he sounds like he was a little bit insane in some ways.
Who knows? He was involved on the project for 43 years. So I think we all have to think about, those of us who are 43 and older, can have to think about what does 43 years feel like? So I think there's an aspect of a slowly boiling frog in that he was able to introduce ideas. So for instance, the building was already started when he joined it, but he added a bay to the nave on each side. So that meant instead of being a three-aisled nave, it became a five-aisled. And then obviously he grew it taller. So I think as his fame grew on his secular projects, obviously, the committee realised that they'd were more than just a humble executive architect. They had someone with his own brilliance to offer the project. So I think he must have been very persuasive and took the project on. They also got a very large bequest in the 1890s, which sort of oxygenated the project considerably.
Yeah. He suffered an unfortunate and unexpected death in 1926. Had he left any writings or notes behind for people who were going to come after?
No. So one of the great stories of Gaudí is that he never wrote a word about his theory of architecture. But he had all these so-called disciples who faithfully recorded his aphorisms as he went through. So we know pretty well what his theory of architecture was as reported by his disciples. But in the last 12 years of the project, he came to a sticky end with his secular projects. Taste changed. He had a litany of projects that didn't finish very well for him. So he was effectively obliged to put the last 12 years of his time into the Sagrada Familia. And I think that led to a quantum shift in his thinking, because whereas he had practiced more or less as a sculptor of sculptures the size of buildings and didn't quite get away with it because it's just not a practical way to deliver large projects, he then had to sort of do a rethink and recalibrate, and fortunately introduced a very sophisticated use of geometry. So it's like a code. And that geometry was captured in very detailed models, scaled models, which, despite their destruction during the Civil War in the 1930s, fragments of them still contained enough information for us to unpack his intentions.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's this mathematical side and the artistic side. Since when has art been practical? And yet it's got this mathematical foundation.
No, I think he like the famous definition of architecture in the Oxford English Dictionary is it's the art or science of building. So even the dictionary can't make its mind up. And Gaudi was extraordinary because he was scientific as well as being a consummate artist and a practical man, because his childhood was spent with his father beating flat sheets of copper into kettles. So he knew all about the formation of space at a practical level.
Mm. So he knew what could be done, and then the challenge became convincing others of that. But he seemed to be quite successful at leading people into his vision. But 10 years after his death, his workshop was then destroyed during the Spanish Civil War, and that really could have been a disaster. Do you think there was a possibility then that the project could have ended? I mean, it almost sounds like there's signs coming from somewhere. People are trying to destroy this project.
Yeah, this isn't the time to get into the church and society in Spain and what happened during the Civil War. But the project was attacked by anarchists who were obviously anti-church and anti-establishment. The reason the building wasn't demolished was that they realised it was a perfect position for machine guns. Because it was over 100 metres tall, the towers. But they did their best to eradicate the project by attacking Gaudi's workshop, because Gaudi ended up not only working on site but living on site. And if the project was relying on drawings, it would have been the end. But because Gaudi produced undrawable buildings, that's always been my interest in architecture, is the undrawable buildings that are not complicated but complex to the extent that you just can't draw them. Mm. And he had found a way, using this modelling technique and advanced geometry, to describe the building. And fortunately that could be unpacked, even though the models were smashed.
You're listening to ABC Radio National's Late Night Live. I'm Tracy Holmes. We're speaking with Professor Mark Burry AO, adjunct professor at Swinburne, who spent nearly 40 years working on La Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. Mark, now you come into this frame and there's a few small fragments of his plaster models, and you've got to try and make sense of that and expand it to the big vision. That's an enormous task. How did you go about that?
So the link was the two directors who, as I said, had worked with Gaudi when he was young. They then said, well, here are these fragments model. We need to know which surface is where and what are the characteristics of them. And initially I couldn't, none of the skills that I'd been taught at architecture school were of any use at all. But I then put my geographer's hat on, because I had done map making at high school. And I realised that what they were asking me to do was make maps of the surviving fragments. And the reason for this is, with a map, we can then translate that information to people who are going to, first of all, make the reproduction models to show that we had got our heads around the project, and then translate that information to the people who are making it, which are stonemasons.
And he had some pretty unorthodox methods. Tell me about the time he hoisted a donkey up onto the Nativity facade.
Oh, well, it's very well known that he, in my opinion, he didn't really make the best use of the sculptors that he had to do the figurative sculpture for the building, in that he actually would make full-scale models of people, donkeys, whatever, from casts or various other methods, and then say to them, I want that, which is not really the right way to go about it. I would have said, you know, I would have described in a few words as a prompt and then let the sculptor do what they wanted. However, it's quite literal. There's the very famous figure of a soldier from Herod who's slaughtering the innocents, and he's got his arm raised with a sword, and he's holding an innocent about to do the worst. And that soldier has six toes. You can't see it. You have to actually clamber on the project, which I could do in those days when OHS was a little bit, health and safety is a little bit less stringent. But there's the soldier with the six toes. And apparently Matamala, the sculptor, had brought in a subject for the, you know, to model the soldier for Gaudí. But he had six toes. And he said to Gaudí, but I suppose I'll make the model with five toes. And Gaudí said, no, we must record nature and all its vicissitudes. So that soldier ends up with his six toes on both feet.
Was there some significance to the six toes? Had he read about that somewhere or seen someone? Or
My view is other things that he did meant that he was very interested in finding the stopping point, you know, the point of perfection for everything. So with these geometries, he could have overcooked or undercooked, but he always seemed to have this touch with these geometries. I think he wanted to record nature as it is and not pretend it was something else. So in this case, the soldier with the six toes was a freak. I don't know how many people were born with six toes, but it's obviously not that many. And he wanted to record that as kind of like a miracle in a way.
So I'm just thinking about the enormity of what you and other team members did. How much of the basilica was actually built when Gaudí died? So that was 100 years ago. What was actually up, which gave you some sort of, a measurement or a scale that you could imagine the rest?
So if we all think of a typical Gothic revival church, you know, have the main body, which is the nave, and it has the two arms, which are the transepts, and then it has the apse. Quite often they're curved round the behind the altar. He had completed one, almost before he died, one of the transepts. So that's the end of the arm, not the main body, and two-thirds of the wall going round the back of the apse. I'd say that's less than 5% of the completed building.
Gee.
But he made the decision to build the nativity facade first rather than putting stone by stone around the whole perimeter of the building to make sure that there was something vertical and highly conspicuous as evidence of progress and also evidence of what the vision was. But so when I joined it, there were two sets of towers on either side of the transepts, nothing of the main body of the church at all. It was a building site.
And his vision included not just the external, but very much looking at the inside, the interior of it, and particularly how it was going to be lit.
Absolutely. He conceived it as a forest. So you're walking in, the columns of the nave are these tree trunks. And this is what gives it such an extraordinary visual effect, is as your eyes go up and up and up, because it's just so tall. It's actually the tallest religious building in the world now that they've finished the cross at the top. So you can get a sense of just how high it is. As your eyes go up, you see these columns branching out. And so you're in this sort of petrified forest with the light coming through, just like you would see in a forest glade.
Yeah, it sounds quite stunning. What about the acoustics?
Yes. Reverberation time of over 12 seconds. It wasn't till it was finished that both the problem and the opportunity were discovered. The problem is that it's a mellifluous sound. I mean, it's just fantastic. If you're in there on your own and you can just clap your hand or prick a balloon, as we did when we were doing acoustic tests, you get this fantastic rolling sound. But that doesn't really suit all situations. On the other hand, it gives opportunities to composers to really think what sounds best in the building. Gaudí actually conceived it as a musical instrument, so every one of those towers around the perimeter was to have tubular bells in it. So it was, rather than just having a carillon in one corner of the building, the whole building was going to be this musical instrument.
The way you describe that, so the pricking of the balloon or the clapping of your hands, that's one thing. What about when you heard music played there for the first time?
The first time we heard it properly used was actually at the inauguration in 2010 when the Pope came to... It had been consecrated already because of the crypt downstairs, but it was inaugurated as a basilica. And, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck stand up now, thinking about my hair standing up on the back of my neck then. It was just glorious.
Incredible. So the final tower, the Tower of Jesus Christ, it's now finished. And you said it's the biggest religious building in the world. But can you give us some sort of comparison? So for those that haven't seen it, what can we measure it against, you know, stories and you know, the overall footprint?
Okay. Well, it's 172.5 metres tall. So you can divide that by three to get stories. So it's getting on for about 60 stories. Of a commercial building. It's because of the shape of the building, and it's tall and it isn't tall, if you know what I mean. It's not like a Gothic cathedral with just one, you know, two spires or one spire. It's got lots of towers. So it has at least four towers around it, which are slightly lower. And it's got the Mary Tower at the over the apse, so it's. I think that's one of the remarkable things about it. It dominates the skyline certainly, but when you're close to it, it doesn't look to be as big as it is when you go into it. And when you go into it, I'd say 10 times would be the scale. It's 10 times bigger than you think it is from the outside.
Really amazing, and I think. I don't know how you think about this as an expert in architecture, but do buildings have a life? They have a life of the person that has designed it or the team that has designed it. But in this particular construction, you're talking about five or six generations of people and the lives and the energy of those people that's been invested in this. Do you think there's a sense of that when you enter the building?
Yes, I'm hesitating slightly because obviously being involved in it for 37 years, a lot of those years it wasn't a finished building, and it was a remarkable building site, and even more remarkable because the public were allowed to go and visit it while it was being built around them. I think the sensation I have now is, if I'm asked, you know, why do I admire Catalonia and Catalan so much? I answer because how many cities the size of Barcelona have produced a building that transcends generations? Mm-hmm. This is a building that, so when you see it and you know the fact that there are many people who worked on it who never saw it finished and could never see it finished because they didn't live, they couldn't, you know, the building was took so long. I think a community that would, first of all, recognise an artist like Gaudí and give him space and something to do, and believe in the project so that despite civil wars, economic cycles, changes in taste and culture, the building survived. Every major city could have done a Sagrada Familia, but as far as I know, only Barcelona has pulled it off in the modern era.
So this week's going to be a huge occasion, a blessing from the Pope, 100 years to the day since Gaudí's death. And I know there's still so much not known about him. It's impossible to know. But have you ever imagined being in his mind, stepping into his shoes and imagining what he would be thinking of this moment and of La Sagrada Familia today?
Yes, I'm often asked, you know, do you think Gaudí would accept what you've done? And all I can do is point to various of his aphorisms, which said that he was setting the project up for others to conclude it. So I imagine he would be critical because he's a critical individual, and whatever we've done in his name, because he is the architect, nobody else has claimed to be anything other than working on Gaudí's project. I imagine that he would be critical because we only have to look at the nativity facade and the rest of the building, and all of us have tried to be as rich and as sculptural, but there's something about the original facade that says Gaudí, and that we miss him.
Really beautiful. Great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tracy.
And that is Mark Burry, AO, adjunct professor at the University of Swinburne and one of the architects responsible for seeing Gaudí's vision become a reality.